Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Rebecca Atkinson-Lord and you're listening to The Legacy Tapes, a series of podcasts exploring legacy and how you might be able to leave something lasting in the ephemeral medium of theatre. And I'm here today talking to Natalie Ebu, who is currently the Artistic Director and Chief Executive of Theatre Verhunzi. And before that, she was Creative Producer for In Good Company at Derby Playhouse. And then before that, again, she was a freelancer like so many of us. So Natalie, we were just talking about what Theatre Verhunzi exists to do.
Yeah.
You were telling me that its primary mission is to bring stories about the African diaspora to a wider audience. In the UK, or do you have aspirations for global domination as well?
Yeah, I think it's sort of twofold actually. So the company was founded by Femi Elifowodjo Jr. to tell stories about the African diaspora in contemporary Britain. And of course, the African diaspora is something that changes from first generation to second generation, as I am, and beyond. So how we serve the African diaspora is a really good question. And I think part of it is about reflecting the complexity of that experience, that perhaps my mum's experience of being actually mixed race African diaspora is different to my experience as a second generation mixed race Scottish girl. And we see our role as changing to reflect the African community as it exists in Britain at this moment, but then also to invite other people into that conversation, because of course the African heritage experience is not a monoculture. That, you know, the colleagues who are Southeast Asian, the lovers that are Polish, the flatmates that are from the Mediterranean are all part of the African heritage experience. So if we're sort of inviting everyone to, let's have a conversation about who we are today.
I feel like that understanding is something that I'm not used to hearing, especially in terms of African diaspora stories. And I often, maybe I'm being unfair, but I often encounter kind of conversations that feel quite exclusive. Has that felt like a big change for you, like within the company? Does that feel like a...
Well, I think it is the nature of the diaspora changes, right? So at one point, the story was about arriving. The story was about what it means to be an immigrant, what it means to have come from somewhere back home, but that's no longer the story. You know, that I share more in common with the Scottish white working class, perhaps, than I do the kind of immigrant generation. And I think that it's really interesting, this idea of exclusive, because I think I, as an African heritage core audience, have also felt that those African narratives have been exclusive when they're singular, because I've never been to Africa before. I mean, that's a lie now, but I went with the British Council to deliver a Shakespeare project, not because, you know, I returned to the motherland.
You were looking for your people.
And, like, you know, when I don't speak the language, and I learnt to cook okra soup, which is, you know, a sort of West African meal, through YouTube and not through my mother. So that I guess what I'm really fired up about is extending and multiplying this idea of, when we think about African, what do we think? Because I'm not that version of African. That doesn't make me or my colleagues or my peers any less African, or the community any less African. It's just we look and sound different now. So it's, I think that certainly, and it's just the result of being the third artistic director of Theatre Verhunzi, and the privilege of being able to take a company and reform it for today, because the kind of traditional narrative served 1997 and maybe even served 2010, but in 2016 the story is different. So we need to catch up.
That's a big, I mean, I feel like they're massive, because I know Femi, who is an overwhelmingly memorable man.
Charismatic.
Charismatic. and also like a force to be reckoned with. And Lucien as well has such a big reputation in the industry, and I remember seeing him in some wonderful things at the RSC that felt kind of transportive. And now you're coming, like, you're kind of filling big shoes with a really important remit and like an agenda or an obligation to kind of be really quite to drive an evolution. And that's, I mean, that's a lot, right? Yeah. That's a lot on your plate in the first.
It is. And it feels really complex because on one hand, it's not innovation because the world looks like this. Like, we're just living really complex and multiple lives.
Yeah.
It just is happening. And all I'm trying to do, really, is make the stories catch up with the lives that we're all living, like, let them reflect the lives we're living.
Yeah.
But within the sector, it feels really difficult because people have expectations of what this company should be
doing. The knockabout Nigerian family drama.
Exactly.
About, morality. Or
yeah, and those plays are great, but they're not the totality of the experience. Yeah. And actually, I can see those stories, and when I say mainstream, I've got the quotation marks because that's a problematic term for me, but like, we can see those stories in the mainstream, and actually the stories we're not seeing are the stories that are actually from the inside that go, actually, you can just take for granted that you're African, but like, tell me what it is to be. There's when I read a play about an African heritage Christian lesbian, let's talk about that, because I've never seen those stories on stage, on the screen. You know, I was at the Barbican What London Watches launch, and in the trailer was a black Scottish man, and I nearly welled up. It was the most sort of transformative moment to just see someone who looked like me and sounded like me. I just had never experienced it, and I was like, gosh, that simple gesture to acknowledge that person is existing in the world is so impactful. And it's about that. It's like, you know, I think we take for granted, and we think it is just about colour, it's just about seeing someone who's the same colour as you on stage, and it's not. It's about the nuance of the experience. So we're trying to do that from the inside, but sorry, I've lost the thread a little bit there with my emotional story of what it means to be seen.
The thread was just there's a lot there for you.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, there is. And it's,
I think that sense of recognising yourself or hearing your voice, I feel like I sound like totally one of the cultural mainstream now, but I'm from the Midlands. Mm. And I have a similar experience when I hear a Midlands accent that isn't belonging to an idiot, or that's a genuine person, and so I can really recognise that. And I think also there's something interesting in I always feel it's massively insulting to define people by anybody by one aspect of their identity. I never think, I'm a white woman, because I have the privilege of not having to think that. But also, I don't ever think I'm a female director. Yeah. I just go about my life, and all of these things are true. So I guess that kind of complexification of the stories and the tapestry of what's in the narrative makes it easier, or is it kind of changes how people think about people in the African diaspora.
Yeah, I guess I have this sort of,
because you get to be a Scottish.
Yeah,
you get to be a million things at once.
I have this sort of theory that actually, if the lens is a second generation African heritage, that actually it's more universal than the heteronormative white male experience.
Yeah.
Because actually we're all living a kind of mixed experience. If you are from the Midlands but you live in London, and educated somewhere else,
grew up in Greece.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That kind of middle space where nowhere is home but everywhere is home, the sense of having to innovate always, that more of us are experiencing that than the kind of singular. Exactly. And so actually, whilst it may feel like it is for a certain audience, our argument is actually for everyone because we're all living this life and let's all just work it out together. I just wanted to touch on your thing about the Midlands voice being the idiot, and I think for me it's about let's get rid of all shortcuts. So if you just flood culture, all different types of everything, then Midlands will never equal idiot. When a black person walks on stage, will never go urban, or there's going to be drugs or an knife crime, or they're going to have a foreign accent.
You're
just not going to know what's going to happen, and that is the best work, right? When you catch me off guard, I think it's just about let's get rid of shortcuts. Those are lazy. And that's the job. Let's flood loads more. You know, it's not about no more should we see the kind of traditional Nigerian family morality play, but let's see that and the, you know,
800 other options.
Exactly.
And I think that's because I think sometimes the terminology around diversity, and I just want to whenever someone uses that word, I want to club myself or them to death. Because no one really knows what it means anymore, or it becomes,
because it just means this, right?
It's just be life. Be life, be different, but that isn't how people use it. They use it like when someone's like, oh, you know, we want to cast a diverse actor, and it's like, well, if you're doing singular, you can't. Diverse means different. And I think maybe we just need to back away from, you're right, back away from those shortcuts and those shorthands and embrace kind of complexity in a really interesting way.
I think, listen, there have been many conversations around diversity where everyone is just really anxious that we're all going to say the wrong thing and offend each other, including me as a black Scottish woman, working class woman. And let's just acknowledge that we're going to get it wrong, and sometimes we're going to use words that offend each other. But if I think the fear to offend silences us, so we don't have proper, meaty, under the skin, get skin in the game kind of conversations. We're all too polite, and that's why we're not making any progress. Like, let's just have the conversation.
And I think if you approach those conversations with an assumption that I am going to come with kindness, and I would assume that other people are coming with the same. Because I think often you can choose to take offence, and if you choose, make that choice, it shuts the conversation down. So sometimes it's better to be like, hey guys, that's all,
we're
not
all here in love and kindness.
Be angry at each other.
But also I should be able to say,
that offends me.
Or, you know, how about this word instead of that word? But I think that's the only way we're really going to make any progress and bring about any changes, if we just get some skin in the game and really properly talk about it. And so that thing of like, oh, we're looking for a diverse actor, I think is powered by like this, you know what you're after, but you're scared to say, like, black feels dangerous, I think, even for me when I hear the word black, because I'm not sure how it's been used, and it's all about context. You know, I do sort of pick up a little bit. It is a loaded word, but we can't be scared of those words. We have to use the language. We have to say what we mean, because it's more offensive to just be like diverse, and that could be like what you mean. Like LGBTQI, do you mean
Filipino?
Do you mean Greek?
That's really that's interesting to hear you say. I think one of the things that, because I've been doing a little bit of work in the States for the past couple of years, and again, like, just the terminology there is different to here, and the dialogue is very different. And I think they're much more obsessed with race inequality, and we're quite obsessed with class inequality. And like, we just don't talk about things in the same way. And things like the term people of colour, which there is that's the phrase, that's the cool phrase. If you use that here as a non-person of colour, or as a person of like slightly pale colour,
you have got colour.
Because I have got colour, I'm not invisible. And so even just talking in vernaculars for your context can get really tricksy, I think.
And it's really complex, and also there isn't like a one word that everyone's happy with. Like, I was doing a project at RADA, and it was ultimately for black or African heritage final year actors, and we co-commissioned Charlene James to write a play for them that embraced them with all their multiplicity, that where we could just take for granted that they're people of colour, and let's go on with telling a story.
So it's context, not subject.
And like, actually it was a really kind of pedestrian, I don't mean that in a kind of derogatory way, but it was a play about grief. But it felt so quietly political, because I've never been in a space where everyone was a person of colour and they were in contemporary clothes and they were living in a really great flat and they had a well-stocked fridge from Waitrose.
They were just working people.
Exactly. And I was like, oh my God, this feels like revolutionary.
Yeah.
And it's so ridiculous that that gesture still feels that way. But the reason I was talking about that was that you could say are a different generation. So I'm 32 and they were like in their early 20s. Mm. And this thing about black and brown and people of colour and like the way that we individuals within the community wish to be defined. Mm. And it is as multiple as the stories.
Mm,
yes. There isn't that we cannot, and I think that's the point, we cannot simplify people.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't want it to stop us having the conversation, but let's just acknowledge that you cannot, it's not one.
Yeah.
You know,
I think maybe some of the changes in how, I'm going to move on to something beyond this in a minute, but I think some of the changes in how we're learning to talk about people following the entrance into kind of mainstream dialogue of trans identity and trans issues, and that sense of asking someone, you know, what are your pronouns?
Mm-hmm.
Which is such a simple kindness, like and a decent thing in getting it right.
Yeah.
There's no reason why you actually couldn't do that. Like, you know, how, if I need to talk about you,
yes, how would you?
How should I do that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I can't help but feel that it's sort of connected to the where are you from question.
Yeah.
Where the issue is that in my experience, how I wish to define myself is not accepted.
Mm-hmm.
So where are you from? I'm from Edinburgh. No. Where are you from?
Where are you really from?
Edinburgh, Scotland. No. Where are you really from? And then, but really what you're asking is, where are my parents from? How am I brown? That's what you want to know. And I guess, whether I already anticipate that we're going to have a battle about how I define myself when you ask the question. And I guess it's the sort of, it's the counter of that. It goes, you have the power to identify who you are, how you want to be referred to, how you identify is. So it's quite interesting that there's a way to kind of bring that, own that,
because
it's been taken away, I think, from people of colour. We're not allowed to define ourselves how we wish to be defined.
It has to be about the motherland.
Yeah. Yeah, or you have to decide who I am and where I'm from.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to approve it.
Yeah. That's quite interesting.
I see you, like, you're the white man.
Yeah, I am. I come here.
Sorry. Yeah. You're representing.
Yeah, I'm in charge of all of my people.
Yeah, it's like the races are communicating today.
Wow, well done.
On the behalf of the black people and you.
Good, because I get that in Greece, like that's the first thing, because I speak Greek with a really strong regional Greek accent, which fucks people up. They're like, you do not look Greek. You, nothing about you passes as Greek except for how you sound. What? And people literally say, what are you, like, what are you? And I'm like, well, I'm difficult and this is fine.
Yeah, so that on a daily,
yeah, it's tough.
It's
really fucking tough. And also because you don't get to, like, it kind of undermines your sense of ownership and belonging in a really problematic way.
Mm.
I think that's a little bit like how we talk about class. Like, class is the only identity, really, that other people ascribe, that we allow other people to ascribe to us.
Yeah.
Like, uniformly. And I think that sense of, oh, you are a brown person and that is all you're allowed.
Yeah.
And I get to say that.
Yeah.
I have no point, I'm just rambling.
No. And it's good to reflect on what you've said.
So
it's tough, isn't it? I'm exhausted already. You see, it's like,
and we're like 10 minutes in or something.
It just does it, doesn't it?
Yeah. So you inherited this, like, I mean, I think my point in all of that was, you inherited this big legacy, this weight of stuff that you have to be conscious of, and that's true in any organisation, like the stuff you have to be conscious of, the political, like, history, and then also because of the company's role in the ecology.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like I'm just thinking about what you got from the past and then, like, what the weight of the future is? Because it's relatively unique.
Yeah.
Do you feel a weight of what you're doing for the future? Do you feel like an obligation? So, you can tell me no and to fuck off.
Well, I just sort of, I'm picking it because, you know, I had to think really carefully about applying for this job because the company had sort of fearlessly, confidently articulated who it was and what it was about, and it was so assured. When the job had come up previously and I'd considered it, I was overwhelmed by that confidence because at that time I was like, who on earth am I? Like, you know, I'd had my first black friend when I was 17. I've been reflected by, you know, in Scotland by pretty white experience. Everyone in my family is mixed race, so I'm the darkest. And it was just like, oh, it's all really messy. How do I articulate my experience? And that's not my experience of being African, so maybe I can't run this company. And then I'd gone on a journey of going, actually, like, isn't that weird that I felt like I couldn't run an African data company or a company that was telling stories about the African experience when I lived the African experience? And that was the thing that made me go, oh yeah, that's a problem. So I've got some shit to do to make sure that the next artistic director doesn't feel like, oh, I'm not that kind of African, so I can't run this company. And that's, you know, no disrespect to the work of Femi and Lucy, and the work they did was incredible. And Femi, you know, what a privilege to be able to take on a company that has existed for, at the time, I think it was 17 years. It's really unusual, I think, for an organisation to move, of this nature, to move beyond its founder.
Yeah.
So that feels like a real privilege. And the company has a lot of generosity around it, and a lot of people feel very kindly towards the company, and it meant a lot for a community of black artists or African heritage artists, and that feels like the legacy that, you know, for those who know us and what we do, warmth is exuded. But it's about evolving the company because, as I said, the community, the diaspora has evolved, and continually sort of weigh up where we should sit and whether there is strength in disengaging with the mainstream and just making our work for people who understand the value to them and who are desperately seeking to see themselves represented in culture, who are turning to film and sport and Twitter and TV and YouTube to see themselves and not coming to theatres, versus actually we are the mainstream, so let us in the door, let us at the table. And that's quite exhausting, the kind of how much of my time I spend arguing about why we should be in those buildings and why this piece of work is important, why there's an audience for it. And I feel like that's the future, is about thinking, how do we exist in this particular ecology? You know, I read an amazing quote from the director of Selma, Ava DuVernay, about in the time of segregation when people were fighting for civil rights and equality, that there were also pockets of places that were purely black, where you could go to a black post office and a black hairdresser and look after each other, where you didn't have to fight the good fight. You didn't have to fight for diversity, and you could replenish. And about the balance of, where does this company replenish, where does the artist and its producers and its audience replenish, where can we not have to justify ourselves all the time, and what's the balance, I think, moving forward. So there's a kind of evolving the work, reflecting our audience, and that's a global audience, a national audience, an audience that doesn't need to share the same skin aesthetic as us, but also about the kind of power that comes from...
That's a really good word that works in so many ways. Sorry, carry on.
Just finding lots of different ways to talk about what, you know, we all know we mean. I've sort of lost it. No, don't worry. I was probably coming to
end. You talk about replenishing and just having that place that's a battery charger.
Yeah, because I think the future is not us about, and not about disengaging with the mainstream, but I just wonder what the balance is. You know, what does a model look like? And we're exploring it, you know, for the next 5 years, a model that that replenishes itself, that makes work for the people it knows are out there, that has direct relationships with those people, sort of not with venues, but then also plays those mainstream spaces and fights that fight and brings about change and disrupts those buildings and those structures and those processes and the way that we talk to audiences. Like, what's that balance, I guess?
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Sorry,
yeah, absolutely. There's something really, you just said something that I'd never realised. And, you know, I spent quite a lot of time thinking about, I don't know what the word that isn't diversity is, but that. And I've never really thought that actually as a non-white artist, you don't ever get to go into a space, a theatre space, and not be political.
I don't get to move in the world and not be political.
Yeah.
But particularly...
But and I was just kind of thinking, because one of the things that I find myself wearying of just now is I'm so sick of being shouty crackers. I'm so sick, just the things that I shout about, you know. I'm so sick of that, and I just want someone to hire me to direct a fucking Noel Coward play. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then even that's political.
Yeah.
So I was just kind of thinking, just that privilege that I hadn't really acknowledged that I had of choosing not to be a symbol, choosing not to be a figurehead. Must be exhausting.
Yeah, it is. I'm sorry to just. Yes, I am really tired.
I want to snooze.
And I want to do it well, but I also don't want to have to do it at all. I think there's something I read and watched that talked about the privilege of forgetting. The moment you can stop partying something.
Yeah.
The moment you can just get on with your life.
Yeah.
And those people who don't have the privilege of forgetting. Not having the privilege of not being political, not walking into a room and going, oh, okay, I'm the only black person here. So whilst I don't want to be the only person talking about diversity, I'm not going to not talk about it, because there is a way where we could
somewhat
get away with not talking about it.
Just talk to me a little bit about, and I don't want this whole conversation to be about brownness.
Yes.
But it is like, it, I mean, that's part of the deal.
Job,
Talk to me about the theatres that you, because I see this happen. I see a lot of theatres and people that I like as artistic directors and curators broadly, I think are kind of awesome and respect. And then I see them program the one thing a year, and I've had conversations recently about a particular play that I want to produce and curate that has two black American characters in the central role. You've read it, know, and curators have come back to me and been like, oh, well, we've got our black play this year,
doing this with this company,
or we don't have a lot of black audience. No. And it's like, yeah, but fuck's sake, because it isn't really about black.
Well, no,
blackness.
But if you're black, then I can't see beyond your blackness.
Yeah.
And if you're black, then your experience is specific. So your story of love is about black love. It's not about love.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
God, we should be past that, shouldn't we?
Indeed, indeed. And like, some, you know, sometimes I think it's not like malicious or conscious, and I think, you know, the argument for diversity at the top means everything will be diverse, like that it just will, because it's about changing the way that you see the world, and I think, or the lens in which you used to see the world. And I was often thinking about like those female-led organisations and how they tend to be the most diverse organisations, and how when you're hiring and you are other in some way or minority, even though we're not a minority as females, but we're made to feel like it, that you don't need to see your difference reflected. You just notice difference, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that's really exciting, that you can lead buildings and actually just respond to that like fire that is about I am different, and I've sat on the outside, and you kind of you connect with that. Whereas, you know, there's an argument for that if you are white, heteronormative, male, middle to upper class, what you're looking for is that direct reflection.
And you're so used to everything talking in your vernacular that as soon as something doesn't, you're like, ugh, I
don't understand it.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about So let's talk about running a company. And this is the thing that kind of interests me, because in my experience, like at Ogle House, one of the things that I was really aware of was like the tension between needing like stability and innovation, or stability and risk, or you know, pick your obnoxiously shorthand words. And how much to like arrive and be like, this is, I respect this and we need to maintain the status quo, and how much actually, when, because as an outsider you can often see the things that need to change, and you get like 6 months before you can't see it anymore, and how much to be like, this, guys, quickly, while I still remember, this is where we need to go. Do you feel that tension, and where do you land? And I mean, you've listened to the other episodes, you've cheated, so you know what the question is.
But I don't know the answer still.
No.
I think that this is where my own professional development as a first-time artistic director and chief exec sort of engages, in that historically, like, I am a freelancer, or I come in and deliver projects, and I have not been really strategic, I think. I've been like, oh, I've got this amazing idea, I'm just going to pull it off, and, you know, until it kills me, we'll do it. And it's happened, but I got through just, you know, by the skin of my teeth.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of what that kind of startup, make shit happen energy was partly what was attractive, I think, to the board who hired me. And what the last 2 years has been about is realising that that's actually not very helpful when you're in a kind of senior role and you've got a company and staff. And so I have been learning around how can I keep that spirit, which I think makes me the producer that I am and the artist that I am, but also like protect everyone and myself actually, and think about sustainability and resilience. And I think it's about processes. But for me, historically, I've always been like, well, why wouldn't you just put more money into projects? Like, why don't you just do more? And realising that actually an investment in infrastructure, an investment in prison, those are all really unsexy words, but like, oh, that allows you
but
to
no,
do more.
Please, for fuck's sake, can someone invest in infrastructure?
Yeah.
Please.
Yes, and I mean, listen, when I say invest in infrastructure, we're tiny, and, you know, when I talk about investment, it's not much.
I don't mean, I mean ecologically.
No, yes, exactly. So I think that's it for me, is going actually, well, I want to be able to take bold risk, you know, it's sort of in our very like DNA, it's about firsts, right? And that often if you are a diaspora, there's so many firsts for you, and so that is built into the kind of character of the company. So if we're going to do that, then what needs to be solid, what needs to be robust, and that I think is processes. That's been surrounding yourself with excellent staff, a team. That's about, you know, computers at work, knowing the filing system works, you know, all that other stuff that allows you to, it's like a Maslow hierarchy, right? You need to know that you've got Wi-Fi in order to do the brilliant idea. And that's actually just so true.
Yeah.
Free yourself of all the other stuff in order to get to that plane of innovation.
Yeah.
Does that answer your
Yes, it does. I guess it's about, it's that those things are symbiotic, which is always true, but I think sometimes a lot of the artistic administrators, like the artistic leaders that are primarily administrators that I speak to, and I know that that's a problematic term, and that like someone somewhere is throwing a metaphorical tomato at my head, but I'm sorry. You know, I've spent a lot of time with boards or with chief execs who were very focused on no risk, and couldn't quite get that no risk is a risk. So I'm just, it's just a question that I'm always kind of curious about.
Yeah,
and I feel
understand.
Like that's a bit of a tension in how some places operate just now.
Yeah, but like this idea of no risk, it doesn't exist though, right? Like lessening your risk, but yeah, it's not an option for us, I think. New work, so we produce new work for risk. We are diverse. Not a risk for us because it's standard normal, but a risk for everyone else everywhere.
Can we trust them?
Yeah, we don't have a black audience though. But do your audience
do you
live in the world?
You don't.
Like, do you live in the world in which there are black people? Then there is a place for this work. You know, this idea that we have no like history. So the number of times I've sat in front of a funder who's assumed that I started this company straight out of university, like 2 years ago, despite the fact they have the application form that says when we were founded.
But also, read Google. Fucking Google.
Sure.
Google me before the meeting.
Sure, but
whatever our status relationship.
Like, I get it, you're busy, but like, it's on the application form that you have in front of you. It's the assumption that when you're black, you have no history. So what, like, great, thank you, you think that I'm 22, but I'm 30, and this company started, you know, like 19 years ago. So that's also tricky, this
I'm
idea that I don't
up,
really know.
We are grown up.
Yes.
We know what we're doing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the idea that we don't know what we're doing, that this is kind of, again, it's that thing of, it sort of perceived to be unusual that a company with this kind of remit could ever exist beyond its founder. So the kind of myth, although even as I say that, I think about Tamasha, I think about Talawa, I think about Cali, all who are beyond their funder, so it's bullshit. But the kind of myth is, it's a charismatic founder, and it's about the founder's
personality cult.
But they're also their mission, and it doesn't exist beyond, it doesn't have any value beyond.
And also, that's a massive betrayal of like the prejudices of that founder, because I mean, we do think of theatre, don't we, as like by floppy haired posh white men who went to Oxbridge. Get your hair cut, guys. That is what we think. And actually, a lot of the time, you know, my boyfriend took me to see a show the other day that was made by that brand of person. And he is that brand of person.
Right.
And when I came out shouting about it, he was quite perturbed that I was politically angered by the existence of the thing. Because that was just how it is. Isn't that what theatre is? Why are you angry? The sky is blue? It's just that the sky isn't blue.
Yes.
It's refracted light.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I don't even have the energy to respond to that. I don't want us not to have those floppy haired middle class white men. Like, I want, no, one or two in competition with the you and the me and the, all of us together.
Yeah.
I saw last night, and she says it takes all sorts to make a world. Yeah, I don't want to eradicate everyone who isn't me, because then we've got the same problem. Can't accept that.
I can't accept it. I'm just there are just days when
the stories that those people are telling and the buildings that they're telling them. So when I go to your building, and the only time I get to see a black woman on stage is when she's being raped and in a war-torn country.
Yeah.
That's a problem. You can tell that story and I'm whispering in the hope that the podcast doesn't pick it up, but of course it does. Like, that's a problem.
Yeah.
And then I sit in your theatre and one of your audience members turns to me, no phone in sight, I've ranted about this on Twitter already, but I just feel like it all is linked. Says to me, remember to turn your phone off, and I was like, I've already turned my phone off. You don't need to worry about me. You need to worry about yourself, kind sir.
Yeah.
Little does he know, because I'm brown, he doesn't know that theatre pays my bills. Theatre pays my mortgage. You don't need to tell me how to perform in theatre, like how to behave.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm getting angry just retelling the story. That arrogance.
Yeah.
Oh.
Ah, yeah. And I'm going to bounce off that into something slightly.
Sure, take me away from that.
Because I just want to talk about the rules of how to behave and I've been thinking a lot about like the democratization of spaces, because I spoke at a thing a little while ago and like didn't really say that we should burn down theatres, but like that was certainly what people took away from it. And one of the things that I said was, you know, that people need to feel like they have ownership. If you want new and different people to come, they need to feel comfortable. And if they feel like they have to rent a suit or a dress to be there, that ain't gonna do it. And I was just kind of, and then someone came back at me and was like, but you know, a lot of our audience really like getting dressed up for theatre. And I'm like, yeah, you know, I remember my first time at the RSC wearing a fucking evening dress. It was really uncomfortable, but the show was great.
Yeah.
And kind of that sense of having that sense of special behaviour is something you do once a month or twice a year. You know, you don't do it all the time.
Mm.
And if we want people to come all the time and take the risk, it needs to be as comfortable as going to the cinema. And I used to, you know, sometimes I go to the cinema in my pyjamas. Don't tell anyone.
Excellent.
So, like, what do you think, like, how do you feel about the rules of how to behave? And do you think, what do you think needs to change? Or does it, doesn't it? Am I being a dick?
No, there, I mean, there are lots of things there. So firstly, I don't know if I do want people to come to the theatre all the time. So I went to Regent's Park Open Theatre just this summer, and I was like thrilled by how much of an event it felt like to me.
Yeah.
I went on my own, I took my own palette lunch, so I didn't even like anything. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't dressed up, but I just, there was like this thrill in the air, and I thought, this is amazing. I'm so thrilled that I have overuse of throat, but so thrilled that I haven't done this in like a couple of years, because this feels amazing.
Yeah, I haven't been excited.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so,
I feel that.
Like, it is okay if people still only come once or twice a year. I'm fine with that. But I also want the possibility that they could come every week. Mm-hmm. And I want the possibility that they could come in their pyjamas.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been deeply offended by all the articles that have complained about new audiences and the way that they behave.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to see Oppenheimer's Richard the... Was it Richard the Third? At... the Lexium as part of the International Festival. Only because
I'm nodding and I don't actually know. Yeah.
I only mention it because the lead actor, who is speaking Shakespeare in both German and English, had the amazing capacity to come out of it, engage and improvise with the audience, and go straight back in.
Yeah.
Straight back in. And I thought, what a muscle, what a discipline. If he can do that, then we can get over someone eating popcorn.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm all about, it's a craft, pay respect, it's a contract.
Yeah.
You pay your money, this is, you're going to give your show, you're going to sit quietly, passively. That's not what I'm asking my audience. But, you know, like, I get it. But I just think, come on, guys, we can handle it. If it means that those people are coming in and having a moment of connection with this thing that we've devoted our lives to, that we feel passionate about, that we make arguments for all the time.
Mm.
Then we can get over it.
I think if we can't, I think if our audience, like, we're doing it wrong. If they're so not into, like, one of the best pieces of theatre, you forget to breathe.
Mm.
Like, you forget who you are, you forget where you are there in the thing. And I was thinking about, like, I quite often, like, you know, I love a box set.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll sit in our house and we'll, you know, we can watch 6 hours of, like, or more, so on a rainy day, you know, of Game of Thrones or of Better Call Saul or of Breaking Bad or, you know, any of those really awesome, Hannibal, which I fucking love. And we'll spend 6 hours doing that. And in that time, people get up to the loo and they'll make a coffee and we'll eat our tea.
Mm.
And, like, someone will, you know, burp or, like, you know, and there are these distractions.
Living.
And the dog comes in and, like, farts at you. And, you know, shit happens. And you're still so in this story because it's brilliant.
Yeah.
And I think if we could, if we can't get over someone fidgeting or someone just not out of malicious bad nastiness, but just because they're in it, or they don't know, or they want to be comfortable, then there isn't enough of a connection between the performer and the audience. Like, if you're watching the audience, you ain't watching the show.
Yes, exactly. And I just think, but also we think about our kind of bespoke processes, models of which we create work.
Mm.
So let's, like, start to think about bespoke models in which people can engage with work. So I think about Nottingham Players, I don't know if they still do it, where they had their Twitter seats on press night, where there are seats that wouldn't distract other people and you could sit and live tweet through it.
Yeah.
And, like, if you think about those box sets we watch and that moment where all of us are watching it at the same time and we're all live tweeting as we watch it, those are glorious moments.
Yeah.
Like, legacy.
Yeah.
And, like, so let's find a way to facilitate those people who want to tweet through it, you know, rather than embarrassing them and shaming them. Like, I think we just gotta mix it up. If the diversity of work that we produce and the ways that we do it, we should diversify the ways that you can engage.
Because there are shows I only watch to tweet my way through them, because the tweeting and being part of that conversation is as fun.
Yeah.
The
watercolour moment that we don't get, where we've watched EastEnders, you know, someone dying, and we all, at that one moment, you know, that happened. happen, like your neighbours when I was growing up or whatever. It doesn't happen in the same way, but it happens, and that I don't want to lose that. And we should be actually inviting theatre to be an event in which you can do that. And I think the other thing I was just going to say about, it's okay for those people who want to come in a ball gown, but it's also okay if you want to come in your joggers or your PJs. And for me, the thing that we are road testing is multiple ways of selling the show. So multiple posters with different protagonists, I guess, on each poster, like a film poster where for Star Wars you'd have the girl or you could have John Boyega. And also multiple copies. So acknowledge.
I just need to pause. Why don't we know her fucking name?
Sorry.
No, it's sorry. Fine, but I just need to say that.
No,
carry on.
No, but also I don't watch Star Wars, so I barely only know.
But you know his name.
Well, only but, because yeah, I know he's a brother.
Yeah.
Not my actual brother, we're not all related.
Oh, you're not?
Yeah.
Oh my god, I've been like addressing Christmas cards wrong for years.
And multiple copies, so acknowledging that some we all go to the theatre for different reasons. And how can I help you see that this play is a way for you to get what you want out of it? And if the reason you come is because it's an event you want to dress up, then let's write copy that's about the event. And if the reason you come is because you want to lose yourself in another world and you want to wear pajamas and you want to eat your popcorn or your McDonald's, let's write the copy that says you can do that with us, and let's make all of these people feel welcome and all of them feel like theatre is a possibility for them. That's it. I'm not trying to make everyone go to the theatre every single night and be like super fans. I just want you to feel like you could.
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah, it might be safe to do that.
Yeah, you're welcome to do it. I want you to do it, but if you don't, cool.
Okay, I could pursue this a little bit more, but I won't because there are other questions I need to ask. Tell me about like you and your place. And hang on, I'm just going to say for the podcast, we're at the lovely Camden People's Theatre, and I don't know if you guys can hear it, but someone somewhere is singing. So if you can hear a ghostly voice, it's
my backing singer.
It's the start of a brilliant show that you should catch here at CPT at some point in the future. So my question is kind of like you, Natalie Ibu, in the world, like what do you want your legacy to be? And I think you can look at it in you can have three stages, right? You can have like you as an artist producer, you here at this organization, and you like when you come to leave this world and shuffle off that mortal coil, like at that point.
Yes. Oh gosh. So oh my goodness. Take a singing break. As the current leader of Teatro Fohunze, the legacy I hope for is for theatres to think they can have more than one black play in a season. For just multitude, it's about the multiple. It's about helping making theatres think differently about how we do what we do, interrupting the way that they work rather than us fitting in their model. For audiences who previously have not considered theatre as a place in which they learn about themselves and the world to think about, oh, I could go see a play to do that. As an individual artist and producer, it's not the total, these are just the things that are at the top of my head, but I do quite a lot of mentoring, and I was struck by the illusion that I had at 16 when I decided I wanted to be an artistic director and had to change my personality in order to do it because I was an introvert. Like, I'm so shy. This is like really expensive for me, just FYI. Like, personally, that still happens. You know, that the people that I mentor still have this impression that in order to work in this industry you need to be super good at networking and be able to go up to people with no cost to yourself and make charming and intelligent conversation, and like, they still think there's a way to be, there's a way to do this. So I hope that my personal legacy, one of the personal legacies, that we just go, there's another way to be in this world. Like, I don't network, I hate it, it makes me cringe. I'd much rather send you an email or tweet you or take you out for a coffee, but I'm not going to sidle up to you in an event and be like, hi Rebecca, I've listened to your podcast, I've read your article, it's so interesting. It's not me. You know, I'm not going to turn up at press nights and work the room. So I just, and you know, on a small level, just want the people that I encounter, the emerging artists I encounter, to just go, oh, you know what, there was another way to do this. And when I leave,
I should feature the caveat that it's okay to say you don't think there should be anything lasting. It is ephemeral.
I just hope, I want that for myself, to be like, Natalie was here and this is what she did. I have this kind of obsession of like, where are we? You know, my freelance brand was Natalie, who was here. I've got here tattooed on me under the watch there. I'll take it off you, babes.
I haven't seen this one. Compare wrist tattoos.
So I have got a thing about that. Knowing where you are and where you've been and where you went. But I don't yet know
where you're going.
Yeah. Or what I want to leave behind. Change of some sort.
That's it, right? That's all there is. Like, you exist in the place and you leave it changed.
Yes.
That's all, like, you're gonna do that.
That's
all there is.
Yeah, but, you know, there have been moments where, you know, as a freelancer, or, like, in the world as a single person, and I've thought, God, if I die tomorrow, I don't know anyone would know, because I don't have to be anywhere. So no one's going to be like, oh, Natalie's meant to be here at 10, and she's not. You know, that I have these moments of going, what impact am I making? Yeah. Does anyone know I'm here?
Yeah.
Like,
I think...
So has everyone.
No. Like, yeah, I have similar things of that. But there was a woman that like lay in her flat, died and lay in her flat.
That's Emmy Ashton who did that.
Movie. Yeah, and like, I mean, I think eventually someone would notice me, but I am aware that there's that sense of because there's a professional thing, then there's a personal thing, right? There's like, does anybody see me?
Yes.
Does someone see me enough that they know I'm not here?
Yeah.
And that can be a personal thing, or it can be like, am I casting enough ripples that someone will notice when they're gone?
Yeah.
And sometimes I find I'm like, no, it's really important to me. Let's just chuck a big rock in now. Let's actually burn, you know, burn it out of my head. Then no one might notice. Yeah. But then I think there's also something about there's a little bit of me that is quite charmed by that this too shall pass. Sense that everything passes to nothing, and maybe the beauty is continuing in spite of that. You know, maybe like that's what this tattoo is about. Like, it's about, you know, maybe the purpose of aspiration, the purpose of endeavor, and the purpose of ambition isn't teleological. It isn't for the final thing.
Yeah, it's for
the joy of the attempt.
Yeah.
So I waver between those two things.
Yeah, and I guess I was just struck by the thing of like, does anyone see me? And if we think again, sorry to bring it back to race.
No, no.
But in a sector that only sees you in one way, or doesn't see you at all, then that's magnified.
Yeah.
Does anyone see me? No, is the answer. Otherwise, I'd be on your stages, mate.
Yeah,
not me personally,
and also there's something about seeing you as actually you as an individual, rather than like, again, I spent a lot of time just this year at conferences and panel events and stuff, and there's like one woman and there's one black or brown person, and you're like, those people aren't, we're not seeing those people, we're seeing them as a representative
and
I find that very frustrating
and sad. I just find it a little bit sad.
Yeah.
And yet I love what we do, and I love this industry, and I just want it to love us back. Do you know what I mean? Like, just,
yeah.
This is like a sort of unrequited love.
Or in some fucked up codependent, like...
Yeah, exactly.
Gaslighting relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah. And why do you... So, just keeping an eye on my time limit. Mm. Why do you do this?
Mm.
Like, so this is like a 10-part question, right?
Right. You're not really great at those. I'm going to forget everything.
Well, no, because it's just... I mean, really, it's just me rambling until we know what the actual question is.
Sure.
Rather than what I say it is. So, like, do you think... There are two schools of people that I talk to. Often there are the people that are like, it's just... Mm. It's frippery. And then there are the people like, this is the thing that will save us from ourselves.
Mm.
And... Like those two, like how do you feel like there is a power or a responsibility or a potential in theatre to affect change? Do you care? And why do you like? What if this all comes under the broad heading of why do you do this?
Yes, I do think theatre has the power to affect change in individuals that then hopefully become ripple out to become bigger change. I think I do this because, and I'm always very sort of wary of this answer because it sounds very selfish, but I'm trying to work some stuff out about life, and I think if I'm asking these questions and other people are asking these questions, so like the kind of the initial impulse is personal, but then it becomes about I want us all to have, like, let's talk about this thing. Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
And but I want more and better stories, and I think if I felt like I was being served and a community of people were being served, then I wouldn't be doing this job. I think that I'm here and I'm engaged because I know we can do better, and I'm going to play my part, and I'm going to encourage and challenge you all to do better, and hopefully we're going to bring about a moment. So we've been thinking a lot about, like, is change a value for Teatro Fluminense? And my question back was like, but if I felt like the sector was doing what it should be doing, then I think we would just be maintaining it. I don't think we would be like, okay, what's the next thing we want to change? So it is time limited in a way. You know, it's that thing of like a charity. What's success for a charity? Well, it doesn't need to exist. Exactly. But I don't think that success for Teatro Fluminense would be that it no longer needs to exist, because I think it's important to have the multitude or the multiples authorship, because I will tell the same story, or Teatro Fluminense will tell the same story as you in a different way. So I'm doing it to work shit out, and because I just think we should have more and better stories, and if we do these both these things, then we will affect change.
Mm-hmm.
And I want us to see each other, all of us, and acknowledge that we share more than we don't share.
Mm-hmm.
And I want us to look after each other. And I, you know, for me, and this is slightly problematic to say, but I think the shootings in America, we can do something about that. Because I feel it's about dehumanising that black body. And the reason it's dehumanised is because you never see it. And you never know that it loves and it hurts and it feels pain. And it wants a future in the way that you want a future. So, you know, I feel like in a very small way, without sounding arrogant, that we can work towards that plight.
Yeah.
That's what I'm about. It's what gets me up in the morning.
That's great. That's interesting. And that thing about like dehumanising that black body, and that's what allows you and not ever seeing that body as a human body.
Yeah.
I think the stories are how that happens.
Mm.
I entirely agree with you. Like, I've been reading a little bit about lots of things recently, but one of them is about how we fetishize and get obsessed by things, and how we focus on the negative as a society, and things like, I mean, if we talk about like Madeleine McCann and how that disappearance had such a massive impact on how and before that Jamie Bolger and before that Ben Needham, you know, those kids whose names are iconic now, has had a massive impact on what parents allow their children to do and how people feel around letting their children have some degree of freedom. Mm-hmm. And I was really curious about why that is, because statistically, you're much less likely to have anything bad happen to you than you ever have been in human history before. And it turns out that psychologically, essentially, as animals, we're social pack animals, and we have a kind of a rolling pack of about 150 faces, and they are our people.
Yeah.
And what happens is anyone that makes their way into that in our brain, an injury to them is as though it is an injury to us. Like, we feel it directly, yeah. Right? So anybody else, if an injury happens to someone else that isn't in that pack, you're like, okay, I'm sad that injury happened to you, but it's okay, I'm still safe. Yeah. That's not me. And what happens, especially with like a media culture, is that when you see that face, that Madeleine McCann face, every like morning, noon, and night for weeks, she becomes part of your pack. So ultimately, what happens is you feel that injury against the self.
Yeah.
And I find that really interesting because it means that we are paranoid about all sorts of crazy things. But it works in the other way, in that if there are no black faces in your pack because you live in a place where there aren't many black or brown people and you don't see them in the stories, then your ability, you just don't empathise with those people as though they are yours.
Yeah.
So it is really fucking, like, neurologically, it's really fucking important.
And we've got a responsibility.
Yeah, and there's, like, science and shit to say that.
I mean, it's so compelling, and when you say it, of course it makes sense.
Yeah.
Of course it makes sense. So we've got a job to do, so let's just get on with it. Like, enough of the round tables, just let me into your theatre to do wobbly. That's what it comes down to. Like,
just let me in.
Just let's make some work that is... you know, reflective of the world.
Yeah.
And just for me, it's really simple, but of course, it has to be overcomplicated.
Yeah. I mean, there is that sense of when the people that call you for the panel on, diversity, and then will not program, and you're like, what have you? You're running this panel. What have you programmed or curated? Let's say 5 years.
Yeah. But the time and the money, just repurpose it, and let's just, you know, take a risk. Because we're risky, so let's do that.
But I feel like there are some places where you say that where I said in a job interview a while back, I have no interest in unnecessary risk aversion, and the entire panel as one wrote it down. I was like, this one's not for me then.
No, exactly. Yeah. It's still telling. Yeah. I love when those moments happen because you've got, this is never going to work.
Can I just go home instead of doing the Q&A now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, this has been really interesting. Are there things that you want to tell me, or that I haven't asked, or that I should have asked, or that are bugging you?
No, this has been great. I feel, having been exhausted at the start, exhilarated now about...
It's nice to have the space to talk about stuff.
Yeah.
Like the macro stuff.
Yes, indeed. Thank you.
That's right, thank you. It's been a joy. Hi, this is Rebecca again. I just wanted to add a little addendum to Natalie's podcast. After we finished recording, about 10 minutes after we parted ways, Natalie sent me an email saying that she would just really like it if I could make it clear that even though she'd kind of been grumbling about how exhausting it is to be fighting the fights that she's fighting in her role, she's really aware of what a privilege it is to also be paid to fight that fight, and then have a slice of autonomy in the world, when she knows that to be a freelancer, she knows what it's like to be a freelancer and feel like you're on the outside, and like there's no way to bring about any change. So she just wanted to make it really clear that she really does appreciate how privileged she is to be in the position that she's in. And she was also concerned that she hadn't managed to articulate that in terms of the legacy, she thinks the most important legacy for the company is probably about possibility, that more and different people of African heritage will feel like they have artistry as a possibility for them, and that more and different people will consider theatre as a place to spend their 15 quid or their free 3 hours as a way to figure out the stuff of life, and that it feels relevant and urgent and absolutely about the lives that they're living. So just to make it absolutely clear, I wanted to pop that on the end. So thanks a lot, Natalie. Okay, thanks, bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.